I may as well. Yeah.
Is this I think we're going to kick this off. Before I start with the introductions on this panel, I'd just like to get a sense as to who's in the audience. If you could maybe just raise your hand if you're familiar, if you know what an MMOG is, if you know what a multiplayer online game is.
Oh, fantastic.
That's helpful. Good. How many of you play a multiplayer online game?
Wow.
How many of you play more than one multiplayer online game? All right. Good. And
at the same time. That's right. How many of you play together?
Thanks. And how many of you work for an online game company? Okay. Great. Good. Well, that's helpful, so we probably don't need to discuss too much about what a massively multiplayer online game is, I guess. So, you know, let's kick off with some introductions. My name's Jeremy Liu. I'm a general partner at Lightspeed Venture Partners, which is an early-stage technology-focused venture capital firm, and among the areas that I cover is online gaming. I'm going to introduce the rest of our panelists and also ask them to deliver a haiku to introduce themselves. I will kick off. My haiku goes as follows. MMOs are hot. Millions of players worldwide. Where is the money? Adrian Cook is seated to my left, and he's an industry watcher. He blogs prolifically at freetoplay.biz, so he has some ideas about what the business model are for MMOs. And Adrian, what is your haiku?
My haiku is not nearly as creative as yours, because I thought I had to actually introduce myself in it as well. So I'm Adrian Crook. I write freetoplay.biz. I produce net games because internet was two syllables. So it was casual. So I had to compress it down. Oh, well.
That was very dull.
I told you.
Thanks, Adrian. Mm-hmm. Sitting next to Adrian is Nabil Hyatt. Nabil is the founder and CEO of Conduit Labs, which is launching a new form of MMO later this year. And Nabil, would you like to say a little bit about yourself in 17 syllables?
We're social and games. At Conduit, we're stealthy, but music drives us.
So a music-based MMO, you heard it first at South by Southwest, coming out of Conduit Labs. Next to Nabil is Michael Acton Smith. He is the founder and CEO of Mind Candy, which has a fairly long and interesting history in both alternative reality games and now also in MMOs, launching a product called Mochi Monsters for kids and big kids in Q2. Michael.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Adopt pet monster, play with it, care, style, and share, but don't let it die.
Almost always good advice.
Actually, Jeremy, can I do a limerick as well? Is that allowed?
I don't think I'm going to be able to stop you, so knock yourself out.
Okay. There once was a monster from Nantucket.
Oh, boy.
It's safe for work, I promise. There once was a monster from Nantucket who watched the Zuckerberg panel from a bucket. He was unimpressed with Miss Sarah Lacey and her antics so flirtatiously racy, so he heckled, and she told him to email her and provide feedback that way. I'm done. No sonnets or anything else.
So I have epic poetry, nothing like that.
That's
all right, great. We'll move on. Joe Herkin on the end is the VP of Business Development for Gaia Online. It's one of the most well-known casual virtual worlds, with more than 5 million unique users per month, with each of those users spending more than an hour per day, which is pretty remarkable. Joe?
Gaia Online rocks. Avi's movies, games galore. Spring blooms eternal. You're supposed to put a season in these things, I found out. Now, I have an alternative last line, too, based on your question, Jeremy, and the last line, Gaia Online rocks, Avi's movies, games galore, I help make the dough.
Wonderful. So here you can, one of the key tips for telling a business development guy from a product guy is makes the dough. So I think we have an audience that is fairly well informed about MMOs, but I think one thing that might be interesting for people to hear about is thoughts as to what constitutes immersiveness for a massively multiplayer online game or a casual world. Is it the number of dimensions? Is it, you know, whether it's 2.5D or 3D? Can a virtual world be be delivered in HTML or in FBML, in the Facebook markup language? Adrian, you keep track of these things. What do you think?
Yeah, for me, you know, you could very narrowly define a casual MMO as something like a Puzzle Pirates would be sort of a truly casual sort of MMO, very strictly by the books in terms of its delivery platform being Java and, you know, its game structure and that kind of stuff. But I think there's sort of a larger story to casual MMOs with things like Facebook and things like Travian, which is an HTML casual MMO. So basically, for me, a casual MMO is sort of any place where a number of people gather, and there's, you know, online, obviously, and there's some sort of game structure, however loose, applied to that. You could even go so far as like a Club Penguin, which is sort of like an avatar chat type thing that has sort of a loose game structure around it. So really, you know, a casual MMO just has sort of that, you know, that online world and sort of a loose game structure implied upon it, and has a reduced barriers to entry in terms of, you know, either price or platform or just the game itself having shorter compulsion loops, that kind of stuff.
So, Joe, what do you think about that? Does a casual MMO need to have a game mechanic?
I guess a casual MMO can be defined across a whole range of different categories. We look at Gaia as a combination of a casual MMO, a social community, virtual world. And I think to make the casual MMO successful, a lot of it is built around the community and the engagement between the users themselves. And I think as you increase and drive that engagement, you increase what's happening and the activity and the amount of fun that you can have.
And Michael, 2D, 2.5D, 3D, HTML, does it matter?
Yeah, I think it matters a lot. We've steered away from the virtual worlds that you actually wander around with an avatar. I think that's becoming an incredibly competitive space. I was sitting at South by Southwest last year on a panel, and it was the first time I heard that Club Penguin had reached about 4 million users and Webkinz was up to about 3 million. And this is only 12 months ago. And a lot of people were quite staggered by that. It's amazing how much has changed over the last year. So I think that space, the virtual worlds, that you wander around is getting very crowded, but there's a lot of other opportunities to look at, as you say, from Facebook games to games like Stardoll, where you dress up and there's a social network wrapped around it, to more quirky stuff like PMOG, passively multiplayer online gaming. Justin Hall gave a great session on that yesterday. So it's pretty broad.
Jeremy, I'll just weigh in quickly on the 2.5 3D issue, because it's one that we look at all the time in Gaia. We're not 3D. And we find that not being 3D actually has a lot of benefits. There's nothing to download. You can access the site or the game or the world from any computer at any time, and it dramatically reduces the barrier to entry. Quick example: MTV has 4 virtual worlds. All of them are 3D. They're all built around their 4 different TV shows: Pimp My Ride, Virtual Laguna Beach, The Hills, etc. They actually came to us and said, "Hey, will you build a Gaia-like experience for us because of the 2.5D interaction that happens?" And we did within Gaia, and in the first 48 hours, we drove more engagement into the Gaia Virtual Hills experience than all of their virtual worlds combined over months. Partly a lot of that due to the engagement opportunity around not having to download anything.
So I think what I'm hearing is that it doesn't matter. What matters is the level of engagement, not the polygon count or the number of dimensions in the experience. But if you extend that all the way through, we talked a lot about community and people interacting with each other, and we said that you can even have these virtual worlds, if they're immersive enough, in HTML. But if you take that to the limit, then is Yahoo Groups virtual world? Nabil?
So I think you said a good word earlier. First of all, you can obviously, like, we can whittle about definitions for, you know, I think we can write PhD theses on this kind of stuff. There's no really absolute answer. I actually don't know whether we're a virtual world or an MMO, and I kind of stopped really caring a little while ago. I think we're building something interesting, and that's what I'm most focused on. I think immersive is the word you use, and I think that's the right word to focus on, right? Is this engagement is something that anything can have, from Yahoo groups to puzzle pirates. I think what we're talking about in most of these experiences is that they have a level of immersion that is much deeper than the way you typically think about a website as a tool. And I think that's maybe a line that I would look at. I think the most immersive is not even a 3D experience, because it's, you know, immersiveness is about what happens in your brain. So the most immersive I can think of that I've ever played is a text MUD. I think that's because you're reading it, you know, and it's all internal in your brain. You get completely wrapped up in that world. And of course, that can be done in HTML. So I think it's all about that sense of place, not the 2D, 3D, or the layer on top of that.
So what I'm hearing then is that a casual world, a casual MMO or a virtual world is an immersive experience that occurs online. And has some sort of game dynamic. Is that something that the panel would mm-hmm. Concur with?
Yeah, and I think the best quote I heard about the graphics issue last year was from Daniel James, who said that graphics don't matter, the mind models the situation. He's the guy behind Three Rings and Puzzle Pirates and Bang Howdy and those kind of games. And I agree. I think certainly as you like go down the scale in terms of age, you know, to sort of tweens and teens and that kind of stuff, these are people that are less graphically sensitive, and as we get older, we sort of start to demand photoreal type stuff, at least sort of historically. And so I think for the market that most of these games seem to cater to primarily, graphics aren't a central sort of selling factor.
Thank you. So let's talk about something you just brought up there a little bit, the demographics. Joe, what would you say is the core demographic for Gaia Online?
We're 13 to 24. About 60% of our users are 16 to 24. So kind of our sweet spot is the, you know, mid to late teen, 15 to 20.
And Michael, what's the target audience that you guys are going to be shooting for at Mind Candy?
So we're going for 7 to 12-year-olds as our primary audience, but there's going to be a pretty significant secondary audience of teens and 20-somethings and even moms and grandmothers.
Everybody.
We hope. Yeah, basically everybody.
All humans. Yeah. Everyone. Beatles, yeah.
Someone's going to come up with the nursing home version of a virtual world at some point soon, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Virtual pets are pretty universal, so we thought that was a good audience to go for.
So, Adrian, as an industry watcher, as you think about some of the more successful virtual worlds and casual MMOs, maybe you could list off a few and tell us a little bit about the core demographics for those folks.
Well, I mean, it ranges anywhere from, you know, the more popular sort of really young kid ones like Club Penguin, you know, being sort of more, let's say, four to six, 7 years old or so, let's say, to really, really narrowly focus it, to like a Habbo Hotel, which is the tweens, teens, to, I mean, you begin to, as you sort of crest the 20-year-old mark, I think that begins to become secondary and tertiary sort of demographics for a lot of these games, even though they probably have significant player bases that fall in those demographics. I think that's where still a lot of the opportunity exists for growth in the sector, is above 20, above 25. But, you know, like Puzzle Pirates, talking to Daniel James about their demographic, I mean, ostensibly it's, you know, only players above 13, but I know they do have a significant amount of their player base below 13.
Well, that wouldn't be Copacabana.
It wouldn't be, so no. And I'm
sure that there are no players under the age of 15. Nabil, I'm sure you have some perspectives on this as you get ready to launch your game. What's the demographic you guys are targeting?
So we're in the growth area that Adrian alluded to, of kind of above, kind of 16 is probably the low floor, and we're aimed mostly at college kids who are starting to build their social lives online. I think a big thing you see from talking to guys at Habbo about the age drop-off, they have a very actually discreet carve-out for when they drop off, and it's about the end of high school, and it's basically when they get a license. And when they start thinking about, they stop the kind of identity play part of their lives as much. It stops being about kind of what can I play online as much. They're still obviously still doing it the rest of their lives. And it becomes more about building their own kind of personal identity. This is when they care about their Facebook identity. They've stopped being X, Y, and Z, and they're now a jock or a theater person or an X, Y, you know, that kind of personal identity. And I think that equals a very different type of product for that demographic.
So given that that's been the traditional success model for a lot of these casual MMOs where people have been experimenting with identity, why are you going after a different market? Where do you see the opportunity, and why do you think it'll be different for you?
There's obviously lots of corollary evidence that people in that age group game, right? That's a core demographic for World of Warcraft and for Xbox Live and for a lot of core games like Guitar Hero and Rock Band. Their core demographic is in the kind of early to mid-20s. So it's not as if these people are we're teaching them about these type of experience for the very first time. What we're doing is, I think, a mixture of taking that demographic mainstream into this more mainstream experience, web-based experience, as well as, frankly, picking up on folks who have now been playing. I think, you know, Club Penguin started in 2001. This is not a new thing. It was just kind of blown up in the last year and a half, but people who've been playing Habbo, Club Penguin, and frankly Gaia have been doing so for quite some time. And so for them, we're looking at, you know, that's the avatar generation. They're very used to that type of experience, and we think they're ready for that next step.
So Adrian, what do you think? Is demographics destiny? Are we going to roll the clock forward 10 years and all of the kids that grew up playing Habbo and Gaia are going to be in the workplace but, you know, continuing to live in virtual worlds?
I think to a certain extent. Like, I know when I talk to people sort of our age, mid-30s and onward, I think that's all right. Certainly outside of the game industry, a lot of them don't really, you know, when I say, oh, you know, we bought a whatever virtual sword for his character, they're like, I have no idea why you would ever buy that. I can't see the meaning in it. It just doesn't make any sense to me. My wife certainly is one of those people just, you know, so I think sort of generationally, there is still a distinction that people of our age and above make between sort of real life and virtual life that those people 25 and under, 20 and under don't make, because they've just sort of grown up in this culture. You know, what you mentioned, Nabil, about just these people have been in these games for a long time. So I think as these people age, certainly their reasons for engaging in these games are going to change. You know, they might move from sort of role-playing different social identities to just wanting, you know, sort of collector motivations or adventure motivations or socializing motivations, but they won't have, they'll retain that lack of distinction between real and virtual life that I think makes them such sort of rabid participants in this sector, you know, in terms of purchasing virtual goods or what have you.
Look at Cyworld, right? I mean, they look at the market penetration in Korea with Cyworld around just a whole range of activities. You've got teachers assigning homework through Cyworld. So the various activities, as our current users are getting older, they're going to start doing more and more in these worlds. And we in the worlds are going to be challenged to figure out ways that we're able to do more than what we're doing now to continue to engage them.
Well, let's pick up on that, Joe, for a second. Do you think that there are actually fundamental differences between the way that these casual worlds and MMOs are used in Asia relative to the way they are here? And do you think that's a cultural thing? Do you think that's a reflection of, broadband penetration? What are your thoughts?
I think it's broadband penetration. I think it's market entry. These things have been around longer in Asia than they have been here, particularly Korea. We were just talking as we were walking down here about, folks who are importing the Korean games into the U.S. And I think the other is just, culturally, the way in America, the way in which these kinds of experiences have evolved. I think virtual worlds have started off a little bit niche and are expanding. You've got the social networks like, you know, MySpace, Facebook, et cetera, who are, massive in terms of their engagement, and there will start to be this combination of the two that will evolve. And a lot of it is just we're absolutely in our infancy. We've been around 5 years. It's a long time. Neopets has been around 10 years. And I think all of us are just starting to figure out what the various pieces are. And in general, getting broad adoption is going to start to drive the kinds of cultural engagements that we think will grow it.
So Nabil said something interesting before, which is that, a lot of the kids that are playing, whether it be Habbo or some of the other virtual worlds, are experimenting with identity play, and that tends to be a diminished component of their motivation when they have more opportunity to experiment with identity play in the real world. I've heard some people hypothesize that some of the popularity of the MMOs in some of the Asian countries is related to this idea of identity play, in that there are more constraints in some of the Asian cultures around your ability to go and try new things and experiment with different aspects of your personality. It sounds like your sense is that this is that's less of a component. I'm addressing this to Joe. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you think that's less of a differentiator than simply kind of longer exposure to the medium.
Yeah, I think it's probably less than longer exposure to the media, but though it is it's absolutely a piece. You just look at mobility in China, for instance, and it's much more difficult to go different places to access different kinds of cultural experiences. You can go online and do things that there's no way you could do anywhere else in the country. So definitely I think that the cultural experience plays a piece, but I think the larger issue is exposure and the market availability itself.
And Michael, you've obviously taken a different perspective because you have focused your game more on the younger audience, where the core players in the West are today. What's the thinking that informed that decision?
Obviously, if you build a great product for a younger audience, it can grow incredibly quickly. The virality is much faster, I think, with that specific audience, as we've seen with Club Penguin and Webkinz and other sites. But as I mentioned earlier, what I love about the product we're building, it's a casual MMO around a much more mainstream subject, virtual pets, as opposed to more traditional MMOs based around fantasy or sci-fi. World of Warcraft is an incredible game with 10 million users, but I think in the grand scheme of that, that's going to seem pretty niche as we go forward. And we see games addressing more mainstream subjects like dancing, Audition Online, that Nexon created has over 100 million players. Kart Rider, a game based around driving carts, again, over 100 million. Maple Story, similar kind of numbers. And I think smart developers over in the West need to start addressing those more mass market subjects, particularly female-focused games. I think if you can create successful multiplayer games focused on the female audience, you'll obviously attract a lot of males. It doesn't work the other way around quite so well.
We're about 55 female, 45 male, and every time I'm talking about it, I say it's the ladies' night principle. If the girls are there, the guys show up.
Nightclub.
So, yeah.
And most game developers are male, so I think that's why we've seen this huge focus on male multiplayer gaming. So big opportunities to focus, particularly on social networks like Facebook. Most of the most popular games are male-focused, vampires with 10 million installs, and Dope Wars and poker. Developing more female games on that will work really well.
You think the guys would have figured that out.
Adrian, one of the themes that we're hearing here is this idea of essentially bringing these massively multiplayer online games outside the core gaming audience that has been traditionally a male audience and a relatively kind of hardcore audience. Mm-hmm. Do you have some observations or commentary on that trend?
Well, it's funny. There was a number that came out last month that I didn't see reported too widely. The Barbie Girls game somehow accumulated 9.5 million users in the first nine months. Yeah, and I mean that sort of speaks very much to your sort of opportunities for growth in the female sort of side of things. I mean, there's a game that caters pretty much exclusively to females, I imagine. So as far as thoughts on that, I mean, I would just agree with Michael Acton Smith.
Thank you.
So that's actually a nice transition. Barbie Girls, 9.5 million registered users in 9 months. We've seen Build-A-Bear, I think 3 million users in 3 months. Lego is launching a world shortly. Webkinz is a well-known success story. We're seeing increasingly people taking their their brands and their IP from the offline world, and equally the MTV guys that you mentioned earlier, Joe. So we're seeing increasingly both media companies and toy companies taking their brand and getting to massive scale very, very quickly on the back of, you know, well-known, well-recognized brands. Would love to hear from perhaps Nabil first and then Michael about what do you do as a startup in an environment that is as crowded as that, where you've got some pretty heavyweight players throwing some weight around. Nabil?
So I think, you know, I think for another reason why we focus on the age group that we do is because we feel like there is an opportunity there, to be frank. There's, if to go after 6 to 8 year olds right now, or 6 to 10 year olds right now, with a targeted proposition for young kids, would, frankly, I would have to have an unbelievable market differentiating idea. And even then would probably have a very hard time in the, you know, onslaught of Zwinky TV ads to get any kind of attention from anybody in that space. Once, you know, as these typical cycles go, you know, once big media wakes up to something, you know, whether they actually release a good product or not, they tend to oversaturate the market like crazy, and kind of everything kind of gets really rough for a good year or two, and then half those products die, and then there's room for another startup again. So, you know, what, you know, one of the ways we're addressing that, frankly, is by going after a market segmentation. It's not even just about demographics; it's about, you know, specific types of people that we think will really enjoy this product that are not being served. And I think, you know, you don't start a startup company looking for every single 25-year-old or every single person between 6 and 8. That's just not viable, right? So you, as long as you have a very, very distinct focus on a specific value proposition, a specific thing that you think you're going to bring value to a certain set of people, and I think the more focused, the better, you'll be fine. There's lots of things to do on the internet, not just games. You're competing with all of them. So,
Michael?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. One of the things we're trying to do with Moshi, I think it's worth talking about some of the ways we plan to make money with these games, you know, the whole idea of the serious revenues in the title. So there's everything from microtransactions and virtual items, which is a very popular way to make money, and companies are doing incredibly well with that.
I think this is a great topic. I want to touch on the business models a bit later, and okay. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, how you think about competing against some of these brands that are, you know, coming out with. I mean, I think Disney's announced $100 million over 10 projects, you know, with their Tinkerbell property.
Mm-hmm. Pixie Hollow.
Pixie Hollow.
Which looks great.
Pirates of the Caribbean Online. They've got a Cars product coming out. Obviously, they own Penguin now. A lot of those will overlap with the market you're targeting. How do you think about that? Do you worry about it? Do you have some thoughts as to how you can differentiate in that environment?
Yeah, good question. I'd much rather compete in a red-hot crowded environment like this than kind of paving the long grass, and which it would have been years ago. So it is going to be tough. There were about 12 announcements at the New York Toy Show the other day, major toy companies launching virtual worlds on their own IP. And as I said at the start, we don't want to compete with Moshi Monsters in a virtual world that you wander around. What we're trying to do is create a very rich emotional connection between the user and their pet. So Neopets have been around, as we say, for almost 10 years now. 220 million Neopets have been adopted. That's a great, great business. But in the age of broadband and advances in flash technologies, we think we can create an animated, interactive little creature that fully feels alive. And so that's the primary differentiator we're going down there. Obviously, we want to build in all the social tools. And the final point is an educational component. So the little monster that you adopt sends you puzzles every day that you have to solve. And the better you do, the more in-game currency you win. And the parents and teachers that we've spoken about love that concept. And that's very important when you're trying to do a two-step sale process where you've got to get the kids interested and loving the game. And then the parents coming on board with the credit card only if they feel the game is safe and it kind of as some kind of educational component. So we feel confident that we are different from any of the many other properties out there in this space.
So what I'm hearing is build a better product, and over time, that will be recognized and that will triumph. Joe, what's your experience been? I mean, you're in the market now.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's fine for the big brands to build their sites. A lot of them, you know, they're very good at building their brands, and movie studios are fantastic at making great movies. It doesn't necessarily mean that they know how to manage the translation from great movie brands into online virtual experiences. And I think, you know, you look at all these numbers and registrants, it's about the unique users and how often they're coming back. If they continue to come back and you continue to provide engagement, you're going to be successful. And I think a lot of the non-studio branded companies out there, like those of us here and others in the space, have a distinct advantage because we're all about building this online experience. We're about providing ongoing engagement. We're not just relying on specific movie brands that take huge amounts of effort to continue to update and provide new engagement, et cetera, et cetera. Disney's going to be successful with Club Penguin because they bought Club Penguin. It's still to be determined how well all of these guys are going to be successful. You know, MTV is a great example. They've been successful with what they've wanted to create, but scaling and building these things and providing ongoing engagement without relying on the TV show or the movies is a challenge.
Well, this certainly hasn't been the first time that the big media companies have tried to build franchises, gaming franchises, around their content IP, and it hasn't worked so well for them to date. So I think you know, there's definitely a lot of hope for the startups in this space. But let's transition to what Michael was starting to get us talking about, which is the topic of this panel, and that is, how the heck do we make some money in this business? Adrian, why don't you kick off? Tell us, is this about selling box software and subscriptions like it has been historically for the last 20, 30 years in the games business?
Yes. No, just kidding. That's good. No, I mean, historically, like for the last 13 years or 11, 12, I've been producing console games like PS1 and PS2 and 360 games. And then the last year or two, I've gotten into this kind of sector and started blogging about it, like Jeremy said. And, you know, actually one of my more popular blog posts was the top 10 revenue models for online games, casual multiplayer games, this kind of stuff. So I'll just rip off some of the revenue models I posted about in there. You know, I think the most common two probably that people recognize in terms of revenue models would be advertisements and virtual item sales. And I probably don't need to cover those too much. But some of the more interesting ones that have come along more recently, the merchandise angle that we've talked about here. Should I cover all of them now or leave some room?
Why don't you run through the list and then sure. We'll dive deeper with some individuals.
Absolutely. So merchandise model, you know, Webkinz, we talked about Barbie Girls with their USB sort of keys that they sell at retail that also serve a double function as being the sort of the friend authorization mechanism so you don't get pedophiles on your kids' friends list. The info sale model that something like Food Fight uses on Facebook. So, you know, you answer a few marketing surveys, generate some cash for yourself to buy some food to throw at somebody else. The affiliate sale model, which also on Facebook, there's a program called Super Rewards that lets Facebook game developers sort of plug this little piece of code in and allow people to purchase. You know, I purchase some FDD flowers and I get a little bit of virtual cash that then I can spend in the game. So there's some really interesting sort of revenue models coming along that, you know, allow people to monetize these online games on different platforms in different ways that are, you know, anywhere from minimally intrusive to somewhat more intrusive. But there are plenty more that I'm sure these guys have opinions on.
So, you know, maybe Michael, you can talk about this merchandise model. Isn't Webkin selling a fuzzy toy that's associated with the game? I mean, is that so different from having that game, you know, delivered on a CD in a jewel case? Isn't it just a fluffier jewel case?
Yeah, it's a very good point, but they're doing extremely well with it. I think revenues $20 million in the last...
That was in the first 24 months they had the retail
and I think place. Just going like that, you know, I think there's a huge amount of growth there. They could be the next Beanie Babies, which was a multi-billion dollar business. So to that point, I think what they've done is basically create a prepaid card, but just created one that you can take to bed with you and cuddle.
That's right.
And that's pretty smart. And I think we'll see a lot of other companies experimenting with similar ideas. Parents are much more comfortable with it, obviously, because there's something tangible there. There's a real product that they feel they're buying. And I think that the other smart thing about Webkinz is that it's only a year subscription, effectively. You have to renew and buy another pet. So yeah, as I say, a lot more opportunity there. And a lot of other companies, as you say, from Barbie Girls to B-Brats to Bellacera, which is a fascinating company, a collectible card game.
The bees,
exactly. I could go on and on. It's a horse game, a virtual world
that goes
sort of like the new,
yeah,
new My Little Pony. So yeah, lots happening there, and the toy industry is important.
Yeah, the Build-A-Bear one is interesting. Isn't the Build-A-Bear, my understanding of the Build-A-Bear one is you assemble the bear in the store or whatever, and then when you sort of redeem it online, it recreates that exact sort of customized bear that you customize in the
exactly.
real world in the game,
exactly.
which is like another step beyond Webkinz.
Yeah, and you can see why the toy industries love this, because they're not just now selling a toy, they're creating a relationship with the customer that will last for many years, they hope.
And it's a lot of personal equity when you do that sort of like terrestrial customization activity and then sort of have that, you know, realized in a virtual world. Like that's a lot of sort of personal equity I have tied up in that is going to make me continue to invest in that virtual world.
Exactly.
Michael, do you want to maybe pick one of those people who are using the physical merchandise model, that perhaps someone that you admire and think is doing a particularly good job of it, and maybe say a few words.
I think Webkinz is way out in front.
Something that might be less well known to the audience.
Okay. Bellacera was one I mentioned.
Why don't you talk a little bit about what Bellacera is doing?
Okay, so Bellacera is a couple of years old. I think it was originally Scandinavian. And then the guy that created... Magic the Gathering, founded at a trade show a couple of years ago, and he's taken it on and got the license for the rest of the world. And it started as a product you would buy at retail, cards, sort of like Pokemon for girls, and then there'd be a scratch-off code on every card.
What's on the card?
So the cards have horses, fantasy horses, like sort of a collectible card version of My Little Pony. And then you scratch off the code and you go online and you get to see your horse. And what they've realized is they're creating a much deeper version now, where there's a virtual world and you'll be able to interact with other people. And I think that's pretty smart. It's growing very rapidly. I think they're up to about, in January, they announced about 1 million users registered. And just doing great stuff.
Let's touch on some of the other business models that have been demonstrating. And virtual goods, I think, is most likely the one that has been most talked about in the industry. Joe, I believe that Guy is doing more than $1 million per month in virtual goods sales. Do you want to talk a little bit about what's driving that?
Yeah, our virtual goods sales has radically spiked over the last few months, and we've done a couple of things. First of all, I think the thing that's made our virtual goods successful is the basis that it's built around this community, and users go and acquire items that they can use for their avatar in their home and expand the kinds of things they can do within the game of Gaia itself and the way they're interacting with their friends. So we used to have this model where everything within Gaia was free with the exception of two items that we made available every month. We called them monthly collectibles, and users would buy those both to wear use for their own avatar or their home, but also to trade on our marketplace. We have a auction site within Gaia where you can trade virtual goods for lots of Gaia gold. That was pretty successful. It started off to help support the servers themselves. And about 3 or 4 months ago, we launched what we call the Gaia Cash Shop, where we now sell items that are only available for cash. That was created by Jacob right over there. As part of the launch of the Gaia Cash Shop, we also created Gaia Cash Cards that you can now acquire in Target and Walmart and Rite Aid. And through that program, we're doing well over $1 million a month. And we come out throughout the course of the month with a range of different items. Some are just really simple items that you can put on your avatar, like a hat or something, you know, some cool thing that isn't available just for Gaia Gold. The other aspect that we found tremendously successful is the notion of evolving items. So it'll start off as one kind of thing, 2 weeks later it turns into something else, and then a range of others. And we actually look at this business as there's just, we barely scratched the surface of the range of items that we can create and the combination of items that can be created. And then having the access to the cash cards in all these, you know, big box stores makes a huge impact on the business.
So it sounds like the major use case for the users is self-expression.
It's self-expression. The other thing that makes it really valuable within Gaia is it's a huge investment. So we have this Gaia auction site. We do 100,000 transactions a day. And users can acquire these items. They can hold on to them for a few months and trade them later on for Gaia Gold. Gaia Gold is the economy within Gaia. And so the notion that you hold on to something, other users want to buy it from you for their Gaia Gold. So it ends up being, there's multiple aspects of engagement around those items. So it's not just about, and I think this is one of the things that makes it interesting and fun for the users is, even if you don't like the thing, you'll buy it because it becomes an investment later on for additional Gaia Gold.
And how do you maintain scarcity in an environment like that? And how do you maintain the relative value of one thing versus another?
It's, you know, again, it's one of these things that we're experimenting with all the time. We don't have an absolute answer on it, but there'll be items that we remove and we'll say, you know, these items are only going to be available for a limited amount of time. We've had items where we've, you know, the day before we remove it is the first time we announce, hey, we're not going to have this available anymore. You know, there's a range of ways to create the excitement and the scarcity. There's some items that there doesn't need to be any particular scarcity. It's fine for them to get traded. You want to kind of manage the way in which users engage with the items themselves. And again, because of the auction component that exists within Gaia, it just adds some additional sophistication, I think, for the business model opportunities.
Adrian?
I was just going to ask, do you use like consumables or item decay at all to get some of the items out of the
We will be doing some of that. Okay. We actually, again, what I was saying earlier, we sort of just scratched the tip of the iceberg,
right.
But there's certainly item decay, there's consumables, there's one-off animations that can be used. There's just a whole range of those kinds of things.
Cool.
There is another aspect of starting to syndicate and distribute virtual good models across different sites as well that we think is a strong opportunity that we'll see growth in.
And you still employing those three guys to open envelopes full of cash?
So we used to, before we had cash cards, a good 20% of our revenue every month would come cash in the mail. You know, crumpled up $5 bills and quarters and nickels and dimes, and we had three or four people in our accounting department whose full-time job was just to open up envelopes and count the cash. We kept those people very closely seated to one of our founders. I've never understood actually why the mailman hasn't realized it's this great big bonus in his mailbag towards the middle of every month when he delivers stuff to Gaia. But we continue to get 10%, maybe a little bit more of our revenue comes cash in the mail. Because of these monthly collectibles, they're only available during the course of a month, so users need to get, you know, pay for them, and we need to get the cash or payment in that course of the month. We had one kid who sent us $5. It was like four singles and coins in a $15 FedEx envelope to make sure that we got that $5 in time.
That's one of the reasons why the kids' space is so challenging, because obviously they don't have access to their own credit cards. And I think the virtual item microtransaction model works extremely well for the older audience, and it's why we're seeing much more subscription. Subscription is much more popular at the younger end, such as RuneScape, which I think is doing about it's about $5 a month to subscribe, well over 1 million people paying for that. So that's a $60 million a year business doing really well. Club Penguin, again, I think their last numbers were 700,000 users were paying about $6 a month. Stardoll doing incredibly well, about 15 million users on that site now. And they started as a microtransaction model, and they switched to subscription because, again, it's much easier for the child to just ask once for the parent to pay that credit card.
I think on the subscription model, for the younger ages, I think under teens and kind of under 10 in particular, the subscription model makes a ton of sense because parents are up for paying a subscription that might be more than they would normally spend for something like this for the extra safety as well. And that the safety concern becomes pretty important. On the teen space, the subscription model is really interesting because teens want to be able to do stuff themselves. They need their parents to a certain extent to pay for stuff, but then they also want to discover it themselves, and there's this interesting dynamic that evolved there.
Nabil?
Yeah, I think one thing about, we were talking about earlier, you're talking about the gift cards you guys have launched. Like, what percentage of your overall revenues are off the gift cards?
It's in the 40 to 50%.
Yeah, I think, you know, for that age group, it works out pretty well. I think my worry is we've touched on a couple different topics here from from like plush dolls to gift cards that are kind of pushing back into a retail model. And that's incredibly valuable, obviously. People are obviously willing to pay more for tangible items. But it also, I think, raises a little bit of a specter of what this industry could turn into. My worry is that the good thing about a web company is that you can launch small, you can iterate quickly, you can grow rapidly with your user base. You can't really do that if you're trying to launch something into retail. You suddenly get driven back into a much more traditional development cycle.
Yeah, but I think you can use retail to support your online web business. So in our case, we're selling cards. The cards can be used to do anything, you know. So,
yeah.
And I think it's also important to sort of recognize the blurred line right now. You've got users in these age groups, they look at stuff online and offline and it all gets combined and I'm going to Target to go buy a car to do something online. It's like totally natural for them.
Yeah, and
it's also I think important to realize that you have 5 million users a month.
That's what
I mean. That's why
it's fine,
you get
at
Target
scale,
to talk
right?
to you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean there is and it's just a piece of the ultimate experience, right?
But I think what you're hearing through the discussion is that the payment mechanisms and the diversity of payment mechanisms that you need to support if you want to have a digital goods model is a non-trivial problem, and one that I think has no simple solutions, but definitely gets easier as you get bigger.
Yeah. And we continue to experiment and look at different options.
Now, I understand your concern, though. Like in the console space, you have sort of a couple gatekeepers, or maybe even more. You know, you've got like that first party, you've got retail, you've got a publisher. So, the difficulty of a startup is many fold. So, starting in an early stage company, layering in more gatekeepers, at least making them sort of critical to your success, probably wouldn't be a great idea.
And again, it gives the incumbent of Disney and huge brands, whether they're releasing crap product or not, they're going to get shelf space because they're also selling 50 other products that they want to get shelf space for. And so it ends up, again, putting a squeeze and making it, it's not right now, obviously. It's all the gift cards and a lot of that stuff's all very, very new, but I'm projecting out a couple of years, right, and saying, what's it going to be like to start a company then and try and actually get revenue, right?
And so, Nabil, just to stick with you for a second, it sounds like Joe is very much focused on the self-expression side of digital goods. If you look to the gray market in World of Warcraft, for example, it's much more about functional goods. It's the awesome sword of awesomeness that lets you be awesome.
Awesome.
Where have you come out with Conduit? Where do you see the opportunities? Is it in self-expression? Is it in functional upgrades or some other area of opportunity?
We'll see what our users tell us in the end, but I think the key for any kind of microtransaction-based economy is monetizing the engagement loop. So it really depends on what your game is about, and I think it's about monetizing that. I think for Gaia, self-expression is a very important part of their engagement loop. It's a very important part of why they're there. So it makes sense. I think trying to charge for virtual clothing kind of willy-nilly across any product is a horrific idea, for instance, I'll take a good example of a game you wouldn't call a casual MMO, but does a lot of these things. Rock Band, for instance, doesn't charge at all for all of the clothing that you can put on your rock star avatars that you're going to play with online, because that wasn't their core engagement loop. The core engagement loop is playing songs. So, they did $150 million in revenue, not from selling boxes, but from just downloadable content in the last 8 weeks. That's people paying $2 for fully DRM'd tracks of music that they're perfectly happy to pay because it's in that core engagement loop.
What's the source of that stat?
That's from Microsoft and Harmonix.
Wow, that's kick-ass.
Then you look at another music property like Audition Online, and clothing is a huge part of that. Nexon are making a lot of money from people just styling their avatars, which has no effect on gameplay whatsoever. Another great stat I heard at GDC the other day was that apparently 75% of virtual items in Korea are gifts, which again, no impact on your performance. It's just a way of kind of connecting and strengthening relationships with other people.
Yeah, I think there's absolutely an argument to be made on both sides of this. Should you be charging for gameplay specific elements, or should you make all of those free and only pay for the enhancement kinds of activities? And you know, we could sit up here for, I could sit up here for an hour and eloquently argue both sides of it. And I think under the right circumstances, both can work or one can work, and we're all trying to figure this out.
Well, given that we only have about 12 more minutes, I'm gonna vote against that. What I'd like to do is to leave a little time for questions from the audience at the end. But before that, I'd like to maybe just explore with Joe a little bit about the other form of monetization that Adrian mentioned, which is advertising and sponsorship. And I know you guys have had a lot of success stories with brands like Scion and WWE. Yeah. Do you want to maybe mention a little bit about what you found to be working, what you found to not be working as well?
Yeah. So we actually launched sponsorship with major brands like Gaia literally a year ago. In that time, we've gone from one movie studio to, you know, dozens of folks doing major immersive sponsorships with us. And it's one of the things that we find is that we have to create this fine balance between user engagement and pushing brands too much. And we are constantly looking at how to manage that right balance. And so what we try to do with every, so there are certain brands that we go after specifically because we think that our users will like them and they're cool and they will add some value in general. But then in the sponsorships that we create, we try to create them in, we try to bring them in ways that they provide interesting, cool new features to the site itself. That gives the brands more exposure and higher appreciation in Gaia. And, you know, Scion's a great example. Scion created this major sponsorship with us, and all of a sudden cars were available in Gaia, and users could go acquire their car. They could customize it with dozens of different Scion-specific items. We just recently had a item creation contest where users were able to create their own items. So giving users all this engagement around around the product. And in the case of Scion, we've had, in less than a year, over 700,000 Scions have been acquired within Gaia. In the case of movies, we're doing stuff with almost every major studio for movie promotions. And in almost every case, and it's Warner Brothers and Sony and Paramount and DreamWorks and, you know, all the major folks, in almost every instance, there are more trailers viewed at Gaia than almost any other site. On the web.
That sounds great, but it sounds like a lot of work. It sounds like each one of these has to be, you know, pretty custom. How do you make money from that?
So there's a couple. So one of the other pieces that we tie in things that users can get as part of engaging in the sponsorship, and the vast majority of the sponsorships now that we have, we haven't fully templatized it, but we've created them in ways that the amount of work that goes into them is radically less than they used to be. The first sponsorship we did was this small little deal with New Line Cinema for this movie, The Last Mimsy, last year. And I don't know, it took us 6 to 8 weeks to create this tiny little thing that we were building for them. And we do massively more engaged and interesting kinds of activities at exponentially less amounts of work. So there is some work that goes into it, but in fact, we've actually reduced the number of engineers over the last couple of months, while we've radically increased not only the number of sponsors, but the kind of stuff that we're doing. So,
what sort of average sponsorship check size are you getting?
It sort of depends on the time, but you know, for a 1 month sponsorship, we're getting sponsorships in the range of 75 to 200K.
200K here, 200K there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah, and we have. We have, 200K, I don't know, it's real money to me, but, you know, for the venture world, it's, you know,
yes.
But, you know, we're actually starting to see deals in the much higher six figures now that we weren't able to attract before. And we're launching campaigns with major brands. We're launching a campaign with Nike, and I think it launches later this week. Major consumer brands are starting to do more with us and the studios and that kind of thing. So, and they're starting to see more engagement around their brand within Gaia than almost anywhere else. A lot of it is defining the success around engagement as opposed to just, you know, click-throughs or CPMs, and working is a larger conversation around working with the ad agencies that makes it a little more complicated.
Great. Thank you, Joe. We're going to have a little bit of time for questions at the end. I'm going to ask people to step up to the microphone that's on the side there, and it looks like we have our first question. If you'd like to direct it to a specific person on the panel, that'd be great.
Actually, I'm going to just open it up to the whole panel. Sorry to do that. My name's Randall Moss. I'm with the American Cancer Society, and I'm the person who's been running the virtual Relay for Life. And we've been doing and looking at all sorts of virtual communities for engagement to drive our education, our advocacy, and our mission. So I guess I put it to you all, in the creation of your virtual communities and your virtual online spaces, is philanthropy or social engagement and social action a component that you look to do? Is it something, a new idea that you hadn't thought of? And if it is, would you be willing to engage us? Because we are very proactive and very eager to continue, again, moving our mission and educating, not necessarily just in the U.S., but worldwide, because we appreciate that your constituents and your customers are not just U.S.-based.
So I'm going to direct that question to Adrian to talk about philanthropic examples in general in virtual worlds, and then I'm going to leave the business development discussions to after the panel's finished.
Jeez. I'm actually going to have to defer because I don't have a ton of...
Then I'll push it to Joe.
...examples.
Yeah, I mean, we would certainly look at those kinds of things. I think a lot of it depends on the world and the opportunities in Gaia. We have message board forums, so there's a lot of interesting education that happens by virtue of the users' interests themselves. A lot of it, I think, needs to be built around what the interest is around the experience and the world it's created.
Okay, thank you.
I guess this is for Nabil and Michael. So one question I have is, so as opposed to building something and having users give you feedback and adjusting that, do you ever think of curating a system where the users are actually actively designing the game that you're building? And or do you do it now?
So there are definitely a little cadre of startups that are trying to create what you call like platforms for creating games. I'll come down on the side of skeptic on that, to be perfectly honest. I think it is what you see in most communities. If you look at something like Doom, which has a very strong modding community, or most of the FPSs have very strong modding communities, you see that they're not creating core game mechanics. They're modifying gameplay to make it their own. And I make this akin to, you know, YouTube has a core mechanic to YouTube. You don't screw with that. You can insert content into that, and that can work, but the feedback loops and everything that's set up, the sharing and the discussions, everything that happens in YouTube that makes it work, you don't let users create the core of your product, because it's your product. And so we have, there's going to be massive amounts of customization and personal ownership with the product that we're creating. Actually, it's very important for the product that we're creating. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you don't, they're only redesigning the product and making their own, right?
Michael.
I'd agree with that. Creating a game is tough. It's very different. YouTube, for instance, user-generated content, putting up a video is much simpler. So, you know, I'm very interested to see what happens with Raph's MetaPlace and see, it is MetaPlace, isn't it? It's like, yeah, see whether people can actually create amazing games there. For us, we don't want users tinkering with the core game mechanic, but obviously giving users the ability to customize parts of the game. So the daily puzzles that they get served, we'd love the users to be able to create their own and then show them off to other people and see how people score on them. And I think that'd be a great educational component. Not in the kind of wider game.
Joe, I've seen a lot of reports about emergent gameplay in Gaia, you know, people putting on plays and
I mean, Gaia, the majority of Gaia is actually user-created engagement, and it's all within a core that we built and create, but in a platform that we build. But we have these forums where there's a whole Gaia theater district where users have gone and written their own plays, and they put them on, and they dress their avatars up accordingly. And there are user-created banks, and there's a whole range of activity within a particular structure that works well.
And I think even in Habbo, I think there's a lot of that emergent gameplay. It's not necessarily. Do you think it is a core mechanic, or do you think it's something that's emerged from the players themselves?
I mean, you know, I think Sulka, who's the lead designer of Habbo, talks about their core game mechanic being, he's actually tried to name it, calling it the gameless game, right? I think the thing about Habbo that they figured out, I mean, they figured it out, that was kind of a by accident the way that whole site came together, but they basically figured out that the game mechanic for them is role play. Right. There is a core game mechanic, and it's about role play. So when they think about item sales, they think about rooms. It's all about how do we augment and extend role play for the players.
Yeah, and what's funny, there was a WWE promotion in Habbo recently where they sort of had a bunch of custom created WWE sort of avatars that I guess you could view and raid, you can't actually embody, but it sort of got people role playing their favorite WWE matches from, you know, historical times or whatever. So that was a phenomenally successful advertising example.
I'm a VP for agency. We actually are doing a pilot for Visa out in Korea and Singapore. And I think that the things you touched on were really interesting because what we saw as a cultural difference being U.S. citizens and working with this audience was, first of all, just the communal nature of how people look at relationships in these countries. You know, the idea of these bongs or bangs where people kind of come together and use the computer together. And then just comparing that kind of communist outlook on life and everyone kind of working together towards a goal as, you know, contrasted to the way we kind of also hit cognitive dissonance in a way that's about the American dream and putting some people forward and everyone else works together. And then when I look at like my own kids and how they behave with Webkinz or, you know, other online groups, they have a very easy time getting together in front of the computer. And I'm just kind of wondering on your take, do you see like the way Korea kind of behaves as a culture around the, you know, computing? Is that a result of the communist culture or that idea?
Are you in North Korea? Well,
I don't want to say communist. I mean communal. But it's kind of the, you know, just the concept of doing things, you know, computing as a group as opposed to here where we kind of as adults see it as more, you know, anonymous and tapping into a larger community that's online.
Anyone want to take that?
McCarthy hated virtual worlds, I think.
There's a massive cultural difference, obviously, starting from the fact that especially in South Korea, which is very different as a culture than, say, Japan, is very different gaming culture. The word gamer in general and gaming, what we're all talking about here, for many people is something that they actually hide, right? We've been out talking to lots and lots of customers, and it's amazing how many times we'll talk to somebody and say, you know, are you a gamer? And they'll say no. And like, do you play online games? No. And then, okay, great. So have you ever played Bejeweled? Oh, I play Bejeweled like 5 hours every day. Like, I can't stop playing Bejeweled. You know, it's... Whereas that's exactly the reverse in South Korea. It's an embedded part of their culture, partly because it is so public. They don't game at home alone as a secluded part of their life. They game in public in these internet cafes, which completely changes how you think about the game, how you think about how you're going to draw sociality out of the game. There's a lot more pressure on a casual MMO in the U.S. market to build the sociality into the gameplay because you're not able to sit next to somebody the way you do in a PC Bang or in something like Rock Band where you can get eye contact, right? So that just completely changes what kind of a product, maybe not what product will be moderately successful, but what product will be, you know, culturally relevant.
Right, and do you think that's like a cultural difference? Like, is this where the U.S. is headed?
I'm going to have to cut that off. You guys can maybe take it up afterwards. There's one more person that's asking a question, and we're out of time, so I want to just have that.
Hi, I'm Jennifer, and I work for Disney Online Studios, so thank you for those comments. But actually, sort of piggybacking on what that other gentleman was saying about sort of other cultures and new, different kinds of casual gaming and where we're going to go next, and I was wondering if maybe you could expound a bit more on where you think the next sort of casual games are. What kind of new things do you think we will be looking to do, and I guess that's it.
I'm going to throw that to Adrian, and then we can wrap up, because I think you know what these two guys think.
Yeah, as far as, I guess the question is, where the sort of casual games opportunities or like casual MMO sort of opportunities lay from a growth perspective. And I think, you know, where we're seeing a lot of these sort of models proved out in terms of the compulsion loops and the revenue models and all that kind of stuff is traditional games first, like all the fantasy stuff, and then secondarily, you know, the stuff that isn't fantasy, like these guys' products. But then, you know, you're going to start to go even further you know, obviously social networks have started to incorporate some of these models as well, and stuff that we currently do, like, you know, fantasy sports and that kind of stuff. We'll start to get these maybe like virtual item sales sort of treatments and stuff like that. So you know, I think there's sort of secondary and tertiary sort of things that we already do that are gaming or social sort of related things online that can certainly start to benefit from a lot of the things we've proved out in the early going in casual games.
Great. Thank you very much. If you guys want to mob the panelists, feel free. They're sitting right here and they can't get out.
Can I just say one last thing very quickly? Don't forget to fill in the yellow slips, whether you loved or loathed the panel. And finally, if you want to adopt your own cute monster, come and see me, and I've got some invite codes. There we go.
Actually, I have one slight adjustment to that. If you loathed it, feel free to forget to fill in the yellow slips.
Let's go.
Thank you. Well done. Yeah, thank you.